Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. My name is David Leopold. I'm the creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and we are coming to you directly from the Algonquin Hotel, the library at the Algonquin Hotel, which is our home away from home for this podcast. You can follow along in the show notes of all the Hirschfeld artwork that we talk about. And today we have a very special guest, Nick von Hoogstraeten, the author of a brand new book, Broadway Poster Art, 1945 to 1969. Now, Nick is the author of Lost Broadway Theaters, which if you haven't seen or read, you should do yourself a favor and get a copy of that book. He's also the author of the award-winning musical Johnny Guitar, courtroom drama. Maybe you've seen his work at Ellis Island, where he wrote Embracing Freedom, a site-specific play performed over 4,000 times there. For television, he helped co-create the long-running KTLA Morning News in L.A. and Private Sessions for A&E. He was also part of the producing teams that created the original FX and captured Broadway musicals for global cinema distribution. So my question to you, Nick, is what terrible thing did you do to end up selling Broadway posters at the Triton Gallery here in New York, which you own and have done for 10 years?
I thought it would be fun to have a change of career.
So no witness protection program or anything.
No witness protection yet. It's good, comes close to it. But I've always, as a kid, I was always loved theater, and my eyes was always drawn to the advertising for it. Mm-hmm. And it just was always, it became a hobby for me. It's finding posters for old shows.
Right.
And then eventually, after 30 some odd years in television, TV changed during that period from, I was basically doing all live shows.
Right.
And on local stations and on networks, then on cable channels. And as we know, the state today of what cable channels are like, and local stations are different, and networks are different. So I was there for that arc. And when it started to dip towards the sunset, I thought, you know, maybe it's time to see what else I can spend the rest of my days with. And I unfortunately stumbled across the poster business. But it's great fun, and certainly has led to this book, which is really a joy to do.
So tell us about the book. You know, give us the sort of some of the highlights. I mean, I can talk about it because I love it. It's, folks, I'm giving you, this is unsolicited advice. Go out and buy this book. If you love Broadway, if you love posters, or you love art, or 1945 or 1969 or anything in between, this book is the book for you. If you love theater posters, you will never get a better collection. I'm like Nick and so many other people love Broadway posters, have other books of Broadway posters. There has never been one more complete than this one.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's... when I started it, the big question that I was having was, what am I going to write about? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not really describing the artwork, because you can see it.
Right.
And I'm not describing the plot of the show other than an occasional half sentence, because that's a different book.
Right.
So what is it? And I had to figure that out, and that was mm-hmm. a real challenge. And I just sort of had no agenda as I was researching. I first picked the images I wanted to put in. And then saw what kind of story they told for each year I was working on. And then if something didn't make sense, I might switch out the image or change a description, or maybe almost eliminate the description for one. You just see the art, but it's so right. close to another poster that you just say, okay, well, this story speaks for both of these. And just saw where it took me. I mean, I think you have to, when you're working on anything creative, you have to kind of throw in all the ingredients into the pot, you turn up the flame a little bit, and then you see what the stew is like.
Remind me not to come to your house for dinner.
I would never come for my stew. And it's fun, you know. So it was an interesting, certainly an interesting experiment for me to try to tell the story without telling the obvious.
Right.
Very hard to do. And I really wasn't sure I'd done it until the book came out. And then people have been responding by saying, wow, you captured the vibe of the period. Or I had no idea that if I was an art director, this is what my life would have been like then, or whatever story, you know, they landed on. And that's cool. The surprise is, when you surprise the author as well as the audience, it's a fun project.
Well, I loved, in a sense, meeting a number of artists. Of course, there's a lot of Hirschfeld in this book, folks. Sure. We know that he did at least 30 posters during this period, and almost all of them are in the book. We will talk about the ones that aren't, and rake Nick over the coals and wonder why he did not include that. But, you know, meeting artists like Tom Morrow, David Klein, was great. And I love to, and I think as we go along, I want to talk a little bit more about them because you know, those names will mean nothing probably to most people listening, but I guarantee you all know their work.
Yeah.
It is so good and so ubiquitous, if you know this period of Broadway history. So that actually brings me to my first question. Why start with 1945?
Well, the war was coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the images before that were focused on social and political aspects of waging war. So after 6 years of war, audiences were ready for a different approach, for something else to be seen. And producers and writers and actors were all hungry for that also. So there was a shift in what the productions were like and what they were trying to get across. And mm-hmm. there was a maturity that people had because of this experience during the war. And also, some of the most influential people in what we could sort of call the modern period, all of that was still 80 years ago, were coming to life and were showing up and were suddenly breaking their way onto the stage in successful ways. Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Rodgers and Hammerstein had their second successful show in this period, which was Carousel. Obviously, Oklahoma was still running. And it just sort of lit a spark under everybody who was ready for a new kind of entertainment.
Right.
And that fire kept igniting, until like the very beginning of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
When then there was like a pullback on the quality of some stuff, other people broke through and did it, but there's also a change of the guard that started the 1945 revolution that really did come to an end at the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, and then a new guard came in. So it just made sense to do this 25-year period. And also there were copyright issues, by the way.
Pesky copyright.
There's a very gray area in there, but I thought just to be safe, you know. And also I couldn't pick up the book. If I kept going, I wouldn't be able to pick up the book.
That's right, folks. You're gonna need to buy two copies of this book because it is big. You're not going to want to take it upstairs or downstairs or to the next room even. You need two copies so you can go to one in every place that you need to see it at.
Absolutely. And if you have, for instance, a four-bedroom house, then you're going to need six because you have a kitchen and one of the bathrooms also.
Well, of course, 1945 is a big, you know, it's the post-war, beginning of the post-war boom. Right. I think it is sort of the beginning of what we consider the American theater. I mean, not to denigrate the 25 years before that, but there's a reason we don't do too many shows from before that. And we don't know the shows as well.
Very true.
And so the musicals that, particularly the musicals, which are very well represented here, not surprisingly, I think they got the best posters because you don't do nothing boring in a musical comedy and on Broadway in this period.
All right. Right. Now, the posters are full of life. They're full of color. Even the ones for the flops make you think, wow, I'd stop and look at this poster for a few minutes. Maybe I'd even go see the show. It's very different. And the shows were improving. I mean, there were still some pretty cheesy fluff shows in there. Not everything was Carousel.
No.
But things did start to change in that direction through this period. The show have one success like that, and people say, oh, maybe we can go a little deeper. Maybe we can have something more than three girls and a guy or three gobs and a gal or whatever it was during the war. So there was, and that was reflected in the art and reflected in what you would see around the city because the art wasn't necessarily just on the playbill cover.
Right.
And at that time, it was everywhere you turned. There were, you know, posters would come in different sizes, mostly the window card, which would be in a ticket broker's
store. And how big was a window card?
Window card was what we have today, 14 right. by 22 inches. There was, okay. They had frames that were basically a standard size. So they printed to the frames.
Right.
And for those of you who wonder, well, what's a ticket broker?
Right.
When you didn't have credit cards and you were living in the suburbs and you wanted to order tickets to a show, you either had to write in and hopefully get one of your dates, or you would go to the box office, or you had an account at a ticket broker and you could call them up and say, I would like 2 for Saturday night. Can you get me South Pacific? No, I'm sorry, you can't have South Pacific for 6 months. All right, well, what have you got? I said, I can give you a free to get ready or something. You know, Kiss Me Kate or whatever, you know. And so you had this relationship with them, and then occasionally that relationship would allow you to get these tickets early on. And they would say, oh, I know the Joneses would love to have this, I'll save it for them. And they could charge a little premium. There was some scalping, but you know, scalping might be $5.
Yeah.
So, not on everything, but on some of the medium. So anyway, so they had the brokers. And the brokers put these window cards up in their shops.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really around town that much, sometimes in store windows, but basically there are so many brokers that if you covered all the New York and suburban and Philadelphia,
right.
D.C., you could pretty much cover your audience with these cards. So that's what the cards were printed for.
Okay.
To generate sales at ticket brokers primarily.
And that's the window card.
That's the window card.
What about the one sheets and the three sheets?
Well, there weren't a lot of one sheets. One sheets are sort of a movie poster size.
Right.
Not so many of those. But three sheets were also all over town. Not only in... Today, you still see them in Schubert Alley, where they run roughly about 42 inches by across and 82 inches high.
Right.
Same proportion as the window card, by the way.
Yeah.
And they there would be, sometimes they were all in one piece, very rarely. They call three sheets because they would glue them up in three pieces.
Right.
But sometimes you would have a 3-in-2, which was a three sheet with two pieces, or a 3-in-4. And you can figure that out.
Right.
So it just depends. And sometimes when you find these old ones, it's can be frustrating because you can find them incomplete.
Right.
You know, you might have piece 1 and 3. Who's got 2? And they were all over. They were on every vacant building. They were on the walls at Schubert Alley. They were actually on the exit doors at the top of the Imperial. You can see a photo in the book of whatever else is playing at the time around there, just lining the outside of the Imperial. They were everywhere, and they were in train stations. So actually, the three sheet got a lot more visibility than the window card. And I've always wondered, and I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing the art was generated for the window card,
right.
but would have to be adaptable to the three sheet easily, proportionately
right.
speaking, because they were really seen a lot. Not so much today.
And the one sheet, though, which they didn't do much of, was not in the same proportion as a window card.
No. So they would have to kind of redesign it a little bit for the printing. And I think that's one of the reasons they didn't use it very often, because that was an extra expense. You
right.
have a producer who's thinking, God, if I make $5,000, I can last 2 weeks.
Right.
Well, they're not going to spend $400 on redesigning the art at that time. They're just not going to.
And these were not printed all over the place. These were printed in one place, if you could tell us about that.
Yes, there was one shop that had been around since the early 1900s called Artcraft Litho. And they had the monopoly on printing for theater posters and advertise. They would also print souvenir books, postcards, taxi cards, subway cards, all different dimensions using the key art. And they had... throughout this period, probably 90% of the business.
And is that just because they were the sort of go-to place, or did they have exclusive contracts with producers, or?
I would imagine it would be a whole variety of things. Sometimes a producer who was doing a lot, let's say David Merrick, for instance, I don't know if this is true, but I could certainly see it happen, is saying, look, I'll take all my work to you, but you'd have to charge me 20% less.
Right.
And they said, okay, if I know I'm going to get 8 shows a year from you, it's worth it. But they also were really good.
Right.
You got great work from these guys, and they were reliable. And the versions I've seen of things where you know somebody went to Artcraft and said, you have to fix this, they would fix it. Mm. So if I was a producer, I'd
This was past stone lithography.
Yeah. Yeah, this was offset. Mm-hmm. It was printed in various ways. It was sometimes printed silk screen, sometimes just printed regular off the, you know, with silk screen, you'd need different screens, different layers right. to do it. But also that's how they printed some of the art. There are examples in the book that show how a background image would be printed first and then they would run it through for the foreground. Now, in some cases, the background would be art and the foreground would be silk screen lettering over the background.
Sure.
There's a poster for a show called Nightlife that shows that. But sometimes they would have black overprinted on the colors where you'd have, say the background color was blue and red in some undetermined shape, or there was a cartoon face or something. They would print the pink of the face, if that was their design, and the bright blue and the green sky in chunks of color. Then the next pass would be the black that went on top of it to define those shapes.
Right.
Depending on what the design was like. It was always a matter of what the design was. But there are many instances of posters going through for multiple passes, and every once in a while you find an incomplete one.
Right.
That was either a test or they just went through.
In the book, there are not only we get a sense of what it looked like in different printing phases, but also I also want to say that the artists, you can see somehow how the artists developed their work before it ever got to Artcraft.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not unlike today. You know, sure. That's the part of the process that hasn't changed in 100 years, which is amazing. An artist will have an idea. Generally, I would imagine a producer would get pitches from either ad agencies or individual artists, but usually it's through an agency, of what the poster might be like for the show. Then they narrow it down to a couple. They go to further development, and finally they say, okay, you're going to do it. Now, here's what we're looking at. And then the artist starts sketching. And we've found in some cases, we found some of the archives of one of the artists from the late 40s. So only did a few posters. His name, George Wachstetter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Who was also a cartoonist for one of the New York papers, his right. journal or something right. like that. Did a lot of illustrations. And he would sit down and probably had read the script and design versions of what he thought it might be. And then you take that to the producer, and the producer or the director will say, no, that's not good. Oh, yeah, I like that. Do more of that. And then you right. go through phase after phase after phase until it finally gets fine-tuned. He'll make versions on tracing paper and color them in, say, well, we could do it this way, we could do it this way, we could do it this way. And this is not computer.
Right.
Remember, this is pencil and ink and erasers and crumpled up paper and things cut out and stuck back together again. And then eventually they would get the design that everybody approved, and then he would go to final art on that. So it's a process, but when you see it in the book, you see it for Texas Little Darlin', but that's the process that almost every show goes through.
Right. And would it often the artist be given a copy of the script to help them understand what they should do as a poster?
You would think.
Right. Well, I mean, because that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I would imagine not all the time.
A title, a short description.
Yeah, then maybe they heard a couple of songs or they got sometimes the scripts were, but in the advance that they needed this art,
sure.
sometimes the scripts weren't showable.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Or might not have anything that they opened on opening night.
Yeah, right. Or they say, well, we mentioned this here, but you can't show it.
Well, that's, again, that's as much as I know this field, to see the photos in the book of these different progressions, either the artist progression or the printing progression, was a real revelation. I learned a great deal about I knew how it was done, but when you see it, it all comes together.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense. There's also from Wachstetter's group, we show three or four versions of the three sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of variation between them.
Right.
But it's interesting why why you would imagine the variations were made. In one case, Pearl Bailey, who was third bill in it, had lesser billing.
Mm-hmm.
and then the next version are building one up top. And then the sketches, again, show the same scene from the show, but from different angles and different ways. And then you say, well, what's the basis of choosing one over the other? And that just becomes gut or...
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever chord was struck.
It's not a science.
That's for sure.
All right. So I want to talk about, as I said, Hirschfeld did about 30 posters during this period out of about 60 posters that we, so far we know that he's done. And actually the book helped me to confirm a couple that I'd never seen the poster, but I thought was very likely. And you have been, of course, very generous with us in supplying us with high-res files for our archives of these posters, because we want to document everything that Hirschfeld did. And the first poster to make an appearance in your book, of course, I had to, you know, you want to know how the family member's doing. Ray Bulger in Three to Make Ready. What a great image that, I mean, it's Ray Bulger essentially jumping off the poster.
Yeah, right. He's got one leg extended much farther than anybody, any other human being's leg has ever been extended. And he's just full of life and energy and humor. And it's inviting you to follow this guy.
Right.
To see where's he going. I want to see what he's up to. Great.
I mean, people forget now. People saw Ray Bulger as the dancer, the eccentric dancer. But he was capturing Ray Bulger as Ray Bulger saw himself. I mean, what he was trying to do, that leg extended, probably couldn't be done anatomically, but it's literally what Ray Bulger was trying to do. And it's interesting because there are the one, almost one of the second pieces to appear is Ray Bulger again in another incredible pose.
Yeah.
It's very similar, but not the same. And it was a maybe 2-year difference or 3-year difference.
Because Where's Charlie? Was
the, from Where's Charlie. Yeah. And of course, that is a very famous show for Hirschfeld and Ray Bulger. Hirschfeld did his Sunday drawing. You know, here he did the poster of Ray Bulger. He could have just done a variation of that or something else. But what he does is he shows Ray Bulger in 7 different poses in Where's Charlie, 7 different costumes, doing 7 different things, all in the air. Because unlike Ray Bulger, Al Hirschfeld was not constrained by gravity. And when the drawing appeared, I mean, here, Al had done the poster, so Bulger would have seen that work. And then this Sunday before the show opens, there's this great drawing. I mean, it's a classic now that appears in the Times. And Bulger is inspired to write Al a note saying, "Mere words must fail to express my admiration of the sensational spread on Sunday. You've always been the greatest, but this time you surpassed even yourself. How you managed to get inside of me and interpret my movements even more graphically than I do is a source of constant amazement to me. Perhaps you are my alter ego. Or, startling thought, perhaps I am yours." And Al was tickled by that. We were just talking about, you know, laughing in the studio. Yes, he would have giggled about that. And although Al was guilty of self-destruction of his correspondence, you know, he got a letter from George Gershwin, he read it, and then he threw it away. This one amused Al, and he tacked it up on his bulletin board for the rest of his life. It spent the rest of Hirschfeld's life on a bulletin board full of millions of things. And just one day we'll do an archaeological dig on going down and seeing what's
the
there.
The layers of the board.
Yeah, there's so much there. But of course, Al was just trying to capture the character of what Bulger was presenting. And it was that kind of sort of, you know, the character was what was going to sell the show.
Yeah.
And so it was quite obvious the producers understood, let's get Hirschfeld for this because he was the perfect thing.
And when you look at it, he's leaping off the page. He's leaping off the cardboard.
Right.
And that would, from the producer's point of view, that's going to stop a ticket buyer in his tracks. If he's at the ticket broker and he sees Ray Bulger jumping at him, I'll go to that.
I love Ray Bulger.
Love to meet him. He's going to jump towards me.
Well, what's interesting is the 3D Make Ready is a color image, mm-hmm. whereas Where's Charlie is a black and white image.
Well, on the poster, it's in, there's color.
Oh, no, that's true. Yeah. It is on the poster. Yeah. And that is why it's really important to see so many of these, not just for the Hirschfeld color. This is a very colorful book. Mm-hmm. This is not a book of boring looking posters. This is a book of, it's pretty exciting, I'm going to be honest with you. One of the very colorful artists is a good friend of Hirschfeld's, Don Freeman.
Oh yeah, Don Freeman's
and
terrific.
You know, for a long time I felt that, oh yeah, he did a few posters, and then in 1947 he had a great year where he did Streetcar and a number of other shows, Finian's Rainbow.
Yeah.
and
High Button Shoes.
Yeah, High Button Shoes.
And Allegro.
Yeah.
And Allegro.
Allegro. And at first I thought, he got all this work because Hirschfeld was out of town. He was traveling around the world. But now I come, you know, seeing so many of Freeman's posters, because you, folks, you can't go look them up just like that. The only place you can look them up like that is Triton Gallery.
Because, it's actually easier in the book.
Yeah, it is easier in the book. There is an index of artists and an index of shows. They are kept separate. And as someone who has looked up now both shows and artists, very useful. This is a useful book.
Well, I'll tell you, when I delivered the book and it was ready and they were going through editing and then we're just almost done, I said, they came back to me and said, oh, by the way, you have to do the index. I excuse me? So my last three full days writing the book was doing the two indexes.
I look at indexing as like, please just shoot me now.
It was all right.
But I'll tell you, people, pay attention. Yeah. The only bad review I got on Amazon for the Hirschfeld Century, somebody criticized the index. Okay. I had nothing to do with it. Luckily, Knopf put that together. But, you know, Don Freeman was exactly the kind of person to do great posters because he loved the theater. I mean, this is a guy who just... It excited him. He loved
actually
all
in a show.
Yes. Oh,
the Beautiful People. Beautiful People.
Yeah.
He played a trumpet player, which he was.
Right. You know, that's how he got started.
Yeah.
He left his horn on the train after a gig one night, and he realized he didn't have another way to earn a living. but he was, he was a student of John Sloan, drew all around the city, but he said he always seemed to gravitate back to Broadway. Because that was a place that sort of all of his dreams came true. And, you know, you could see anything happening. Yeah, and, you know, when he found out you could draw the theater, you know, and get paid for it, he was the happiest could be.
And there are two great backstage posters that he did. Me and Juliet.
Oh, yeah.
For Rodgers and Hammerstein. And then one of his last posters was Say Darling, which was a musical based on the writing and producing of The Pajama Game.
Yes.
And it's a backstage view also.
Sure.
Literally... upstage looking out past the sets and the wings to the audience. And they're both so evocative of his life and of what it's been like to be a performer or a writer or someone involved in professional and non-professional theater too.
Well, if you know the drawings he did for the newspapers, yeah. They are rarely what's going on stage.
Right.
It's Hirschfeld called him backstage drunk.
Yeah.
And he was much more interested in what the spot operator was doing or, you know, what was going on in the wings while something else was happening on stage. So he might have been just the perfect person for those.
Absolutely.
The one that I can't, all of his posters which are in the book, all of his posters that are in the book, you can almost tell right away it's Don Freeman.
Yeah.
Except one, which arguably I think is his... is probably the one that more people have seen than any other because it's still used today, which is his poster for Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that image, why Irene Selznick thought that Don Freeman should do... I mean, Don Freeman was the guy you did for musical comedy.
Right.
You know, most of his posters were full of, I mean, tons of people running around doing things. His poster for High Button Shoes is a great example.
It's chaos in that poster.
It's chaos. But Allegro is the same thing. Yeah. And Me and Juliet are the same thing. And then here's this serious drama that, I mean, certainly is all about the personality of the figures. But that's not what he draws. He draws this sort of very, you know, almost mournful scene of a New Orleans street.
Yeah.
And yet it is completely evocative of the show. And as I said, it's you can go see that play somewhere tonight. Mm-hmm. And almost certainly someone's going to be using Don Freeman's work.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, he also did Orpheus Descending.
Yes.
Which is completely not his style, the final version.
Yeah.
There was a previous version which you can say, oh, yeah, that sort of looks like Don Freeman. But the final one is...
Didn't recognize it.
Unrecognized. It's an abstract guitar with a figure fleeing over it. Yeah. If it is a figure, it could be a flame. It could be a bird flying over it. We don't really know. Yeah, very different from him.
Well, that's something I also noticed in the book is 5960... There is like this moment. It's like somebody flicks a switch and the posters become much more abstract and vivid colors. I mean, it tracks with what we know about contemporary design in America at that time.
What was that?
But I mean, it literally is, they're all one way and then they all turn into another
switch. But that's a good point. We can't forget that this reflects contemporary design. These were designers working at the time, and the ones who were pushing the envelope were there. I mean, that period is when Freeman stopped drawing.
Right.
David Klein stopped drawing. Mm-hmm. That period. Klein was one of my favorites. His day job was doing most of the famous TWA travel posters. And should you ever be at JFK Airport and have time, go to Terminal 5, which is the old TWA terminal. Now it's a hotel. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a whole exhibit of his TWA posters in the lobby of the terminal now. Great place. So there was a seismic shift.
Right.
When the 60s hit.
Right. And we see a different kind of show, too.
Oh, very much so.
You know, West Side Story is sort of the beginning of the end of that of the early period.
Right. And rarely used photography.
Right. Yes. Very unusual.
Which up to then, you're not going to see, for musicals particularly,
right.
You would not see many posters with photography on it.
And it is sort of, we're starting to see the beginnings of using more photography rather than hand-drawn illustration. Yeah. Across the board,
yep.
Magazines, newspapers, everything. Whatnot.
Yeah.
So you talked about David Klein.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a few of the posters that he did? Because I'm sure everyone's going to say, "Oh, I know that one."
Yeah. Right. Well, David Klein was the art director on the Death of a Salesman poster. The image was by an artist named Joseph Hirsch, but Klein directed it. He did the typography on it, and it's a beaten up, broken down salesman with bags that are too heavy to carry. His shoulders are slumped, and you know that he's, every step hurts him. And that's been the cover for people today, it's the cover of the play. And if you've ever studied the play in school, you've seen that cover, that
sure.
poster there. But interestingly enough, it wasn't ready when the show tried out in Philadelphia. Mm. So they just had a placeholder, which was type and cast and crew and the theater on the bottom. And then eventually they came to this poster. But Klein's poster doesn't have any credits on it.
Hmm.
So that Philadelphia placeholder that is in the book is actually the only time the original cast was and creative crew were put on a poster.
Oh, really?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which Klein also did, had full credits on it.
Right.
But Death of a Salesman did not.
Well, you put Death of a Salesman on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. We should talk about the three posters that are on the cover of the book because I'm delighted to say one of them is a Hirschfeld. Why don't you tell us about the three posters or the two other posters and why you put them on the book?
Right. Well, the first one on going left to right is Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which is a fantastic Hirschfeld. The second is Death of a Salesman. The third is by Faye Gage. Who one of the few female artists around,
right.
Who started in the late 50s and then carried through into mid-70s. There were some designs from her still. How to Succeed. The choice of what you put on a book cover is part of it's determined by the fact that a book cover is advertising versus content of the book.
It's your poster for the book.
Yeah, it's my poster for the book. So to include certain works, you need to get permission or and consider what might advertise what's inside the book the way you want. So we had permission for all these to be used. And it also, as much as I wanted to put something a little more obscure, perhaps, on the book, that might not serve the purpose for people who would be drawn to it if they saw something familiar.
Right.
So remember, the cover's advertising. So just because you love the show that ran 2 days in Philadelphia in 1961, that might not be the best way to attract someone to pick up the book and flip through it. So I thought because of the way the art is and because of what the shows are, this would be a good way to let people know there's some treasures in here.
Well, now, Gentlemen for Blondes, this is the original Hirschfeld-drawn window card for the 1949 production. Yeah. But when the show toured, this was not the poster this that was used.
Yeah, they didn't use this one. Again, now let's put your producer hat on. Mm-hmm. So you have the show. It's a hit in New York. Columbia Records has made the album. And the album sells like 200,000 copies in over the course of three or four months. And you think, wow, this is crazy. They're advertising my show from it. And the album uses different artwork.
Right.
The cover. So I'm the producer now, and I think, I'm sending the show out to 50 different cities, and the only way they know the show is from the album cover.
Right.
So in this instance, they licensed the art from the album, re-proportioned it, and made that the window card for the tour. So the Hirschfeld's only Broadway.
And it's also on
sheet music, and there, I think there was a like Kansas State Festival poster that was there. So it would show up in various forms occasionally. Right. But.
And it's not Carol Channing.
No.
You know, that's the thing that it and in fact, it's not signed, which is not unusual for this work, poster work. You know, people, the art director didn't care if you knew who the artist was or not. And the artist just wanted to make sure that if there was going to be a name, it was going to be his on the check from the, from the producer. But it is a wonderful image when people, you know, we just had a, we post drawings every day on our social media of drawings from the state. And I think just yesterday was the drawing of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes because it was the Sunday before the show opened. Mm-hmm. And it's not this drawing. It's not, it doesn't even look like this drawing. Yet this drawing captures the feeling of the show just like the drawing that appeared in the paper captured the feeling of the show. They're just different works.
Points of view.
Yeah, exactly. From the same artist.
It's great. It's great. That's one of the greatest things about art. So how do you know, because there's so many different directions to go, having the ability to pick the direction that works the best is rare.
And then the one we haven't talked about too much, I guess, well, How to Succeed, you told us about Fake Age. My brother was in a high school production of this. And of course, one of the very first pieces of theater iconography I think I may have seen, you know, so instantly recognized. one of my favorites in the book and of Hirschfeld's poster work is Bell, Book, and Candle.
Oh, yeah.
Where he has got the very important cat, Peewacket, in the show, playing with a ball of thread that has given us the profiles in line of Rex Harrison and Lily Palmer, the stars of the show. And I would argue that it seems like only Al Hirschfeld could do that, you know, where we get we get Rex Harrison and Lily Palmer. We can see them, even though it's really just a line of thread that you're seeing.
Yeah. It's a crazy creative image, and I would imagine, you know, from the lay point of view, so difficult to draw.
Yeah, I think that's what he was about. He didn't want to do the drawing that you thought he should do. He wanted to do the drawing that he didn't know how to do, and challenge himself. But that was used in, like so many of these images, they were used in the newspaper ads, which would have, as colorful as these images are, a lot of these images, when they appear in the newspaper, there was no color
in the paper. You know. But there were early versions of the poster would be the same illustration, like the out-of-town version for, say, Philadelphia, where you're only going to use it for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. They'll print a cheap version. So that same plate of black and white art, or sometimes blue and white art. It is just one color is okay, whatever, red and white sometimes. Could be a good translation into a newspaper ad.
Sure. So I want to ask you, in terms of Hirschfeld, why this one and not that one, if you have answers for that. But you include a poster that a lot of people would not have seen because nobody saw the show, mm-hmm. called Bonanza Bound.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one. Well, that, you answered your own question a little bit. So I was trying to find a mix of, oh, yeah, everybody's seen Kismet.
Right.
To nobody's seen Bonanza Bound.
Yeah.
And that's but Bonanza Bound is a great illustration.
Your classic Compton and Green musical about the gold rush and, Klondike gold rush.
Yeah, and where the protagonist in the poster is buried in thigh deep snow.
Yeah.
Which his footprints are the letters O and A and Bonanza Bound, where he's sinking down into the snow. It's great. You see, right. By not seeing the snow, you see the blizzard.
Right.
The snow's just the blank page.
That's Hirschfeld. Yeah. You know, the man who, as John Russell said, can make the white of the board act as his henchman, friend.
Well, this is a perfect example of that, as Bonanza Man.
Yeah, no, exactly. As soon as you said it, I said, well, of course you get Hirschfeld to do that because snow is no problem for him. a poster that is not in there, but I was surprised, Man and Superman, Maurice Evans, 1947. It's a wonderful image. For all of us who know My Fair Lady, this actually, this is 10 years earlier, or 9 years earlier, and it's Shaw manipulating marionettes of Maurice Evans and the leading lady just over a proscenium. Mm-hmm. It was not the original poster for the show. Hirschfeld had done this drawing the Sunday before it opened, and the producers must have liked it so much that they ditched the thing that they had and used this as the poster. And eventually it became the program cover when the production toured, because Evans would always tour. He was, part of that generation that believed you did a season in New York and then you had that responsibility to take it on the road and bring theater to people.
Right.
And so he went on the road and it was an image. And I just thought, oh, this is such a classic. I mean, in my small world, it's a classic. Was it something that you just felt you had too much of Hirschfeld? Or?
No, not really. I wasn't restricting any specific artist. Mm-hmm. It was kind of in the balance of the year mm-hmm. and the balance of whatever story the year was telling me.
Sure.
And sometimes stuff got cut or didn't get consideration because it wasn't, as each chapter was sort of organically growing, it didn't seem a place for that plant.
Sure, sure.
I also, sometimes when I was tying things together, I would lose my chronology mm-hmm. to make the point. So I would say, this was used there. Oh, and by the way, 3 years later, there's also this image.
Right.
Because it didn't really have a place in the next chapter. And I knew I was going to open 1956 with the full page of My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
And then I was going to have other versions on the opposing page of mm-hmm. the original, which was just type, and then the final one, cracks me up. They advertise in London, final 2 years.
Yeah.
So get your tickets now. And I thought, well, I can't put this, where it's matching the design, it wouldn't fit there either. So it just became,
it's funny that you bring that up because, Al would end up doing a variation of his classic poster. His original, of course, is very much Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But as time went on, they were no longer in the show. And Hirschfeld did a generic version of it, which is still used today.
Yeah.
I mean, and I thought, he's going to put that one in. And then when you had the London one, I'm like, Harrison and Andrews aren't even in this show. Why are we seeing them on this poster?
It was for the last 2 years.
Yeah, right.
I've never seen that before or since.
That's one of the great, there's all this sort of, I say, sly humor throughout. If you love the theater, you see something like this And of course, it's a laugh right away. Yeah. Final 2 years.
Seriously? In your dreams.
One of the posters you have in here, reclining figure. Mm. 1954. Image. You don't tell the story in the book. I wish you did because it's a great story. Harvey Kunitz satire on art collectors and art and contemporary art. And it shows a reclining model, topless, who's got like a scarf covered over her bottom half. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 1954, you know. So, and it's a beautiful poster. And it's a classic Hirschfeld. And when it came, and of course, it was not only used as a poster, it was going to be used in print ads. Mm-hmm. And so the producers took it to the New York Times. New York Times looked at it and says, we can't print this. And they went to Hirschfeld and said, we won't print this unless you put a bra on it. And sure enough, that's what they did, you know, which Hirschfeld thought was hilarious, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, you know, the first version of the poster mm-hmm. was not a Hirschfeld. Mm-hmm. And it was pink background about a figure in a picture frame. Mm. Because that is it's the reclining figure is a work of art.
Yes, no, of course.
That is a plot point in the show. So they were very, they weren't shy about saying, okay, this is about a painting mm-hmm. that causes all this chaos in this play. But when the final version was done, then there's an ambiguity as to who is this person? Is this a character in the show?
Right.
Which, or is it a painting? Or are we going to see this person? Which I think is smart.
Right.
You know, you want the audience to be enticed.
Right.
And that poster
I want to see what happens.
Certainly do it. So maybe the first version was a little too spot on. And they said, wait a minute, no, this doesn't help us. How are we going to get people curious?
Right.
And certainly the final poster does.
Do you think that that producers went to Hirschfeld? He seems to have drawn more than most artists. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how many David Klein did over the years.
There were a lot, but Hirschfeld, there are more.
Yeah. Do you think that he was just so synonymous with Broadway that it sort of told people that, you know, this was, I don't know, like it's something you associated with the theater. Like, oh, I like Hirschfeld. Yeah. I like, well, let's go to that one.
But also remember, every Sunday morning,
yeah,
you picked it up and there was a Hirschfeld on your face.
Right.
And the Arts and Leisure section of the Times, section 2, was read by every person who was working on Broadway.
Sure.
And that was his resume. That was his
he had an exhibition.
Yeah.
Although we think of it as every week, it is on average every other week.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, during the theater season, it might be every week, you know, this in April. Right. Say, yeah, it would be a lot of drawings. July, not so many. Although he started drawing summer theaters.
Yeah, why not?
It turns out theater is an all year round. It's not baseball.
Well, also remember, and you'll see it sporadically through the book, a number of shows hit summer stock first. So they were up and running as tryouts at, you know, in Skowhegan or in Westbury or you know, even in Denver, stock tryouts for shows that came to New York.
The world of theater has changed so much. Now we use regional theaters as our tryout houses, although they're not really tryouts. Right. If they do well enough, they'll go to Broadway. Yeah. The whole tryout world, I mean, that was such a part of the theater world until about 1980.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't seem like in 1980 now, of course, is much farther away than we think. But
no, it was just like a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Well, there's one story, and it's happened with a number of shows that were doing stock tryout. There's one that was doing a tryout and really desperately wanted to come into New York, but didn't have a theater because the Marasco was booked with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof 4 weeks after this other show called Tonight in Summer Canned or Kind or something like that with Louis Jordan was in the mid-50s. So these neophyte producers, I don't know, let's say we'll take the theater. But they going in knowing they had to move out
right
4 weeks later. And of course, there was no business. And so they had to close it down. And then there were lawsuits about unpaid directors and things. But just that the theater world was so busy. If you felt you were ready and you had a chance to get your show in a New York theater, you took it.
Right.
Which is why I have a lot of short runs.
And well, look, and capitalizing a show at that time was a lot of money by those dollars,
right.
But it wasn't as much money. I mean, Hirschfeld said it used to be you could open up, you know, for a little bit of money. And he said, you know, later in his career, it was like starting U.S. Steel.
Yeah, that's true.
So it was a different industry.
And that's why you had 80 shows a season, maybe.
Right.
Didn't mean you had more hits or fewer flops, percentage-wise.
Right.
You just had more of them.
Well, you not only had more shows, you had more theaters.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, people, if a producer's got a show and something opens up, they'll jump on it because right. There's so few theaters. Right. I mean, what is there?
There are 440, one or two right now.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, a lot of the theaters in the period of this book were dedicated towards radio studios, television mm-hmm. studios, some films,
sure.
film. I mean, of theaters that are active now, there were probably close to a dozen that were taken over by broadcast facilities at that time.
Some came back and some didn't.
Yeah, and some didn't. Usually the fringe ones. So it's interesting, you almost, it's like, it's not so much the loss of theaters within Times Square, although the building of the hotel where four were torn down was certainly shocking. It was a shrinking of the outskirts
right.
that came in. So every theater north of 54th Street is gone.
Right.
And there used to be a dozen. Every theater south of 41st Street is gone, with the exception of the Al Hirschfeld. All of them west of 8th. Not that there were that many. And there are only a few west of 6th.
Well, east of...
Or east of Broadway.
Yes. Yeah, so that world literally shrunk.
It just shrunk. Yeah.
All right. Well, in closing, as we've talked about a lot of posters in the book. Is a poster or an artist or something about the book that we haven't touched on?
Well, I think just realize when you look through it that you're on a journey of changing times.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see in 1940, once you take the arc through and you get to 1969, go back to 1945 and get a sense of how it got there. Where did it start in this 25-year period? Coming out of a really difficult time, and suddenly people can breathe again. Also, though, look at the freedoms that people achieved for themselves, or at least the change in some sort of society norms, as you move into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I bring in a lot more off-Broadway.
I noticed that. I wanted to make a point of that.
Because that's really where the story was being told, with few exceptions. I mean, read about Raisin in the Sun. I mean, that was a game changer,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people didn't have faith that it could happen.
Right.
And then going into the gay rights and sort of...
Anti-war.
Anti-war and body freedoms, where it was acceptable to have nudity on stage, and artists were less constrained by how they could represent their works. All of that's really started to come up in 65, 66, 67, and then you realize, you know, like dipping their toes in the water. There was one show called The Beard, which was a two-character show about Jesse James and Jean Harlow having an affair. Okay. And it apparently was quite erotic and ran into trouble in San Francisco, where mm-hmm. the censors in California were still much stronger than they were in New York. So they ran intentionally a short run there to sort of get the kinks out of it, or put the kinks into it. And the cast members during the, I think, 15 performance run were arrested 14 times. There were only two in the cast. And then it came to New York, and no one cared. Nobody could care less. And they just ran for 300 performances. It made some money. It came in with this great, great scandal from the West Coast. And that was the 60s here.
Yeah.
The late 60s. So it was just almost unimaginable seismic shift if you had taken audiences from 1945 and plopped them in 1968, they would have thought they were on Mars.
Well, you know, you say that, but Al Hirschfeld was in that audience in 1945. And he's in the audience in 1968 when Hair.
Right.
But, you know, for a sophisticated theater goer like Hirschfeld, nudity on stage, he'd been seen in the 20s.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in Earl Cowell's Vanities or mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. that. And, you know, the body wasn't going to shock Al Hirschfeld. Yeah. And I always think he draws this incredible drawing of Hair. He's 65 years old, which to me doesn't seem that old now, but it must have seemed ancient in 1968.
Right.
And yet he gets it.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is, he's about a halfway period then. You know, he's been doing it for 40-some years.
Can you imagine? So here you are, 68, and you're saying, yeah, I guess people think, he's going to wind this up soon.
And not he's got chance. Another 32 years to go. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's stunning. The last Hirschfeld thing I'll say about the book, something I was a real revelation to me, Man of La Mancha. I think another gateway drawing for Hirschfeld fans because they saw the poster. Of course, the cast album had that great image on it. And I just always assumed that was the poster for the show. I mean, he had done a drawing for the Times, which was not this drawing. But it turns out it was not the first drawing for the show.
No.
It seems hard to believe these days because it is, to me, so wrapped up in Man of La Mancha.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people. And why do you have any idea?
Well, Oscar Liebman, who was known mostly for doing paperback covers, mm-hmm. Did the first drawing for La Mancha. He had done theater posters for 110 in the Shade mm-hmm. and Bajour.
Oh, yeah.
He had done sketches that were unpublished for Gypsy and for a lot of stuff he did. He did TV sketches for Jack Parr mm-hmm. of that era. And the story that I've heard is that people liked his work and they used it. Obviously, they chose it to do it. But when Hirschfeld's Times illustration came out, I assume you might know better than me, but they went to him and said, we want to use this for the Times. And he redrew it?
No, this was not the drawing he did for the Times. The drawing he did for the Times shows Don Quixote chasing her. And it's a wonderful drawing. And again, it captures the character of the show. That's what I'm saying is they went back to him
and
asked him to
this.
Draw something new. Because the drawing he did for the Times was horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it occupied like six columns of the page. And they needed something much squarer, much more vertical for a window card. And he comes up with this image that really neatly summarizes the whole show.
Yeah. Now let me ask you, did he do the album cover before this illustration came out, do you think?
So that I don't know. You have a better sense of when it started to appear on posters.
Yeah. This is obviously the second version because it's quote ads, there are no prices on it. It's still the theater downtown, which mm-hmm. it ran for a long time before it moved uptown. So the other, I've always heard of it in connection with the LP cover.
Mm.
So
makes sense. Was the LP on Columbia?
No, it was on Knapp, KNAPP records. And then I think they sold it at MCA or something.
Right.
But my guess, and this is where the detective work comes in, you just have to say, well, maybe it was this way. My guess is it was driven by the album cover.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Because this would have made a great album cover.
Yeah, it did, and that's what's out.
Okay, we've solved another mystery here on the Hirschfeld Century podcast.
That's what we're here for.
Bring us your cold cases. We're good on that. Well, I want to thank you, Nick, for joining us today. Listen, everybody, pause this. Go to your bookstore. Or go online and order Broadway Poster Art 1945 to 1969, published by Schiffer Press. Schiffer Press, and they did a great job. It is a beautiful book. And is there a link that we're going to put it in the show notes?
Yeah.
Can they find you at Triton Gallery?
Oh, yes, they can reach me at Triton Gallery. The book is on our website, as well.
Okay. And what's the URL for Triton Galleries?
It's either to broadwayposters.com or www.tritongallery.com.
There it is, folks. You've been given the keys to the kingdom.
Pretty basic.
All of this information will be in the show notes. So, and all the posters that we've talked about here, if they're by Hirschfeld, we'll have links on our two images that you can see them.
Right.
So take advantage of that. You don't have to imagine what we're talking about. You can see what we're talking about. We want to not only thank Nick, we want to thank the Algonquin Hotel for hosting us again. They're always so kind to us here. If you have any questions, comments, advice, complaints, send them to Catherine at info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org. Look for us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Al Hirschfeld or Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And if you want to find our website, it is alhirschfeldfoundation.org. Visit our shop, alhirschfeldfoundationshop.org or hirschfeldhomestyle.com, where you can find a whole slew of home decor products. We want to wish everybody very happy holidays and a happy new year, and we will see you in it. Thank you very much. Take care.